Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing well, Todd. How about yourself?
Things are going well. I have to say the transition between the two administrations has, I think it's gone, in, for the most part, more smoothly than I would have anticipated. I'm curious if that's been your reaction as well.
Actually, it has been my reaction as well. It's been surprisingly as well. There's a lot of reasons I have in my head for that, but some of them are valid and some of them are just personal perspectives. So I'll just say that, you know, and the first topic we're going to discuss today is a perfect example of that because it involves the whole distribution system of the vaccine and kind of what we inherited and what it's taken for the administration to kind of get its hands around the subject matter.
Yeah, so why don't we start there? I mean, it seems like the distribution is speeding in the United States, hopefully in several other countries in the world. Hopefully that'll start happening in the rest of the world because it really is important for this to be a global vaccination effort. But what are you seeing in terms of changes here in the United States?
I agree with you. I think things are beginning to really pick up here. I know that we are all concerned that we not move too fast in terms of relaxing our standards in various states. But yes, it is definitely picking up. Biden has been very clear about when he wants everyone to be eligible to at least be registered to get the vaccine. And states are taking him seriously. And, you know, he moved up that May 1 date to April 18th, April 19th. I'm here in Virginia, and so are you. I think April 18th will be today that Virginia will allow everyone to be lined up who's over the age of 16, 16 and over. So, yeah, there's a lot of movement there. There's a lot of concern now that we work with the rest of the world because it will do no good if the United States and its citizens are vaccinated and the rest of the world is not vaccinated. That's not going to work. I mean, we'll just keep having new variants come out and things will continue to just spiral on out of control. So we are seeing a lot of coordination on that side as well.
And I think the big news is, of course, the administration's decision to dedicate part of the stockpile at a national level to patients and staff in dialysis facilities. What's the update on that topic?
Well, that's a hot topic. And, you know, I'm sorry, but we got to toot our horn a little bit. ASN really played a big role. And as you know, because you were one of the conveners of all the players in the field to make that happen. And we all of us in the community had to really push with CDC and push with the White House. I never got the impression that either CDC or the White House didn't understand the need for it. The catch was they just didn't have as much vaccine as they needed, and states were clamoring for that vaccine. So to be able to get past that point and be able to make that decision was something we were really pleased to see. And just, you know, recently we've been joining the chief medical officers of various, you know, nonprofits and for-profit dialysis providers and groups from around the country. And they are really reporting some very good progress where, you know, they're seeing a lot more acceptance of the vaccine inside the dialysis facility with patients than they were concerned about before, because the patients really are comfortable, it seems, to be, you know, vaccinated in those facilities. And as that's coming about, that's really seemed to have changed a lot of minds. And, I've also been hearing reports that with dialysis staff, there was some real hesitancy about taking the vaccine at first. And now that the vaccine is becoming available and they're seeing their own dialysis patients take the staff, that the chief medical officers are saying they're really seeing a change in the perspective of dialysis staff. And of course, we want, you know, we've got to allow everyone to make their own medical decisions for themselves. And that's core decision. But that's very good news. And, you know, our listeners are going to have to deal with something that's going to be occurring in the upcoming weeks, which was being talked about in numerous conversations I've been in this week, which is our members are very much working with CMS and CDC to make sure that with that vaccine and dialysis patients, we are monitoring the results and monitoring the levels of antibodies that are being produced. So, you know, a lot of our members think there's going to be an avalanche of studies, kind of at first, maybe pointing to the idea that it's not that effective with dialysis patients. We're still beginning to debate that with transplant patients as well. So I know that a lot of our members have really been saying that they want everyone to kind of let that go through its cycle in the next couple of weeks, and then let's see more long-term what the results really are.
Yeah, you had mentioned that the administration's decision to allocate some of its supply of vaccines to dialysis facilities wouldn't have happened without the advocacy of the community. And I think the advocacy of the community is a good transition to our next topic. And if we go back and we look historically at everything that's happened related to kidney health policy, if it's the legislation in the 70s to create the Medicare ESRD program, if it's the efforts around sort of the payment changes for dialysis in this country, if it's any of the advances related to funding for research, particularly at the National Institutes of Health, if we look at what happened last year with the immunosuppressive drug coverage bill, and most importantly, I would argue, the only large sort of executive order that looks at a disease state and lays out a comprehensive plan for ways to focus on, in our case, kidney health, and really shifts the focus to one of raising awareness, trying to identify people at risk for kidney disease, slowing the progression of the disease, increasing transplant, increasing research innovation, and also changing and innovating how we deliver care and thinking about payment mechanisms. None of that would have happened unless the entire community worked together. And again, we have these two recent examples of the Immunosuppressive Drug Coverage Act, and we also have the example of the vaccine allocation. And that was every member of the community, from the dialysis organizations to the health professionals, including the nephrologists, to the patients, to the pharmaceutical companies and the biotech and the device manufacturers, everyone working together on the same goal. And defining the community not just as the dialysis community or the transplant community, but taking a bigger view of the entire, every aspect of kidney diseases and every aspect of ways we treat for people with kidney diseases. And so given that, I have to say I'm really disappointed that there seems to be a rift in the community related to transplant policy. And I'm wondering if you could help us both understand that rift and walk us through how we're going to solve it.
Well, I'm going to assume that one of the things you're talking about has been the dispute over the organ procurement organization metrics and that final rule, which has just gone into effect. And the debate around it was so divisive that when it went into effect, the administration didn't even put out a press release. They didn't basically say anything. And so that is a rule that, and a step that ASM really lobbied for, because it really takes the metrics that evaluate the OPOs, the organ procurement organizations, who, you know, they're the ones who go out to collect deceased organs for donation. And those are private contracts. They're large contracts. And there's not really been much, in our opinion, accountability in that process. So we wanted to see more objective and transparent data being reported, and to have it be more common and universal across all the OPOs. But that was a really difficult challenge, because they really did argue a great deal that nothing needed to be changed. And I think, quite honestly, some of the arguments that were advanced did not really encourage good debate. They did frighten people. And so I'm hoping that as we move forward on that, because we've got a lot of other pieces of transplant to work on, that battle does not, you know, block us or does not become a barrier to us making more progress. Because it is a really good start. And it's the first time in, I think you and I talked about, over 35 years that there's been a really significant change in how that whole process works. So that's something I think we need to move beyond, because we've got a lot of other pieces that we need to see, we need to make happen.
So David, I think that's well said. You've really, you know, you had predicted that ultimately the final rule would go into effect. So, you know, congratulations to you and everyone responsible for getting us to this point. You know, I think the other rift in our community around transplant policy has to do with the Living Donor Protection Act. And I recognize that the legislation as proposed has raised some concerns. I have every confidence that we could address those concerns. But I think we have to take a serious step back about how our community functions and recognize that the only way we are going to do what's best for the millions of people with kidney diseases and with kidney failure is to work together. And I recognize that there are processes that can be improved. I recognize that there are policy proposals we may not all agree on, but we need to start focusing on what's truly important. And at this moment in time, we have a lot of momentum. And so my hope is, as you said, we can build on that momentum and build on some of these issues. And I'm just sort of curious, as you look at transplant policy, so you have the OPO metrics, you have the issues around the Living Donor Protection Act. What else is on the agenda to really improve transplant policy in the United States?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. The best way to deal with any disagreements we have is to continue pushing for what's really important, and that is for patients. And the more we push for that and movement goes forward, I think the less likely that we are to get stuck on other issues and be divisive in our dialogue. So I think that is really the way to go. For example, we just recently have joined with others in the kidney community to meet with HRSA, the Health Resources Services Administration, which does a lot of the work around transplant, particularly on waitlisting. And we really are kind of trying to get their attention to go, guys, you know, we realize that you know, we have to protect patient confidentiality. But at the same time, the nephrology care team is the major source of referral of transplant candidates. And when they go into that system, we don't really, you know, nephrologists don't really have a very easy, transparent way to evaluate where their patients are, to find out if all the examinations have been completed, if they are active or inactive. And this is going to be where we're going to need to really deal with some of the issues around the transplant wait list and the transplant center operations, the way we are having to deal with the OPOs. You know, it's just not going to work. And there's a lot of ways in which the system can be, you know, you can make it very difficult for people to really truly see what's going on in transplant, the way in which you list organs and list recipients. And a lot of our researchers have been able to really produce some very strong research on that. And I mean, even just in the last couple of weeks in JASN, you know, I mean, our members have produced very good research that basically demonstrates that over the last two decades, there's been almost no improvement in waitlisting time for patients. And that's, you can't say that's just about a tighter supply of organs. It just doesn't work that way. So I think that's really a big one. We're going to have to go to the transplant issue, you know, within transplant centers and make sure that we do not structure the penalties in such a way that centers are penalized for taking some, you know, less than perfect organs and less than perfect recipient candidates, because I think a lot of the metrics have kind of made them completely adverse to taking any chances. And that's just, I mean, that's not the way healthcare should work. It should be really putting all of its efforts into making patients as whole as it can. And that's going to be really important. And we also, as the mandatory payment model for nephrology gets underway, right now, CMS is beginning to award a contract for kidney transplant learning collaborative. And that is going to be a really important step that really tries to promote the best options and actually tries to, you know, affect change in the whole system as we try to get more patients in that model to be preemptively transplanted.
So let me close with kind of a wonky question. You mentioned the learning collaborative. What's the difference, or is there a difference between a learning collaborative and a technical expert panel?
A technical expert panel, as many of my members will know, that is a very specific, finite group of individuals who are selected to really review very particular items, like episode cost calculations, or what are best procedures after catheters, you know, have been in place, or how to get to fistulas first. And so that's a very discrete group of individuals, in our case, usually nephrologists, who will look at measures and look at procedures and come out with recommendations for the government to how to quality measure something or pay for something or to encourage something or to discourage something. Whereas the learning collaborative has got to really go across everyone from the OPOs to the transplant centers to the nephrology practice to the dialysis facility. And it's got to be able to be actively involved, and with the ESRD networks as well, it's got to be actively involved in really trying to really focus on where and how things are being done that really are providing better outcomes for patients, and making that a part of how we kind of talk about these procedures and implementing them. So that's a longer term process. And they all need input of nephrology, but I think in particular, the learning collaborative needs more than just the nephrologist. It needs pretty much everyone on the care team.
Well, David, we should probably stop there. So thank you. Look forward to talking to you soon, and I hope you continue to enjoy the spring.
Thank you very much, Todd, and same to all of our listeners.